From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and I'm broadcasting again today from Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming as we celebrate the 100th birthday of the National Park System. And we're sitting here on the porch at the Old Faithful Inn looking out at Old Faithful, which is steaming. It went off in the last hour or so, so we won't get it for a little bit longer. It goes off every 90 minutes or so. But, Meg, I have to tell you before we get to the news about something that we did last night. The park here is beautiful in the daytime, but it's also really something to see at night. So we went about 10 minutes away from the lodge to a boardwalk over geysers and springs where there are absolutely no lights, and we were able to see the most incredible night sky with Saturn and Mars in view, but also the Milky Way. A couple of shooting stars went by, and Peter O'Dowd, who is here with me, and people may have heard his story yesterday about bears and what to do in case of a bear attack. He had the bear spray. We did not have to use it, thankfully. And by the way, later this week, Peter is going to be bringing you more about what happens at Yellowstone at night. So stay tuned for that and for the rest of our coverage today.
Well, we will start that coverage with news that Russia's team will not be able to compete in the Paralympics in Rio next month. The Court of Arbitration for Sport today rejected Russia's appeal of a ban originally issued by the International Paralympic Committee. Philip Craven is the president of the IPC.
The doping culture that is polluting Russian sport stems from the Russian government and has now been uncovered in not one, but two independent commissioned reports by the World Anti-Doping Agency.
The BBC's Oleg Bolyarev joins us from Moscow. And Oleg, first, Russia's track and field athletes were banned from the summer games that just ended in Rio. Now all the Paralympics athletes will be banned. So what's the reaction there?
Predictably very angry, even more so probably because the rumor had it that the CAS actually reacted favorably to the Russian appeal. But this illusion only lasted a few hours, and this afternoon we found out that the entire Paralympic squad is sitting at home.
So just a few hours there of hope. Is there any other avenue for appeal, or is this the final word?
Well, technically, Moscow can appeal to a federal court in Switzerland, but it can only bring any procedural deficiencies in the decision. It would not be able to discuss the essential matter. What the Russians are trying to say and what they've been saying all along is that they don't deny that the doping problem is here, but they say essentially this is an individual issue. We should deal with individual sportsmen, individual coaches who are using performance-enhancing drugs, but not the largest body of sportsmen. And let's not forget, Russia was prepared to put essentially a very large squad, I think 230 or 230 or 250 sports people.
So you maybe anticipated the question I was going to ask, which is, has Russia taken any steps to clean up this problem? I mean, maybe to improve the testing regimen of athletes? Anything like that at all?
We just had a temporary head of Russian anti-doping agency. She went out of her way to convince us that Russia is very serious, that President Putin has appointed a Russian representative in the IOC to oversee precisely the issue of doping, that Russia will be doing all it can to fight it. But obviously, this works well with the internal audience. As far as the foreign listeners are concerned, then perhaps this argument is a bit flagging.
Well, in Rio, for the Olympic Games that just wrapped up, Russia won 52 medals, of course, none in track and field. At the 2012 Paralympics in London, Russian athletes took home more than 100 medals total, second only to China on the medals table in the Paralympics. I mean, obviously, another way of putting it is that Russia clearly, for many, many years, has been a major player in both sets of Olympic Games. I'm wondering how much these bans and this constant controversy surrounding Russian athletics is setting back Russian sport in general.
I just spoke to Oksana Savchenko. She is an 8-times Paralympic champion in swimming. She's now heading the center, which is preparing para-athletes. And she says the situation is very dangerous. She says, as a country, we must pull together and come out of it. Well, nothing more specific, she could say. And she's also convinced this is politics. Essentially, the vast majority of Russians, if you ask them, would agree that there's lots of dishonesty. And sports officials are much too preoccupied with the medal counts. But they say other countries cheat as well. There are problems in Kenya. There are problems in Turkey. Why is Russia singled out, and why is it being dealt with so harshly in a such massive scale?
Well, that's the BBC's Oleg Bolderev speaking to us from Moscow. Oleg, many thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Well, and as we know, the other big controversy at the Rio Olympics involved four U.S. swimmers and a gas station. USA Today released an exhaustive investigation over the weekend that looked into what really happened between swimmer Ryan Lochte, his other three colleagues, and Brazilian security. Lochte has now admitted he exaggerated the encounter, but the USA Today report also questions the Brazilian retelling of what happened. Well, joining us now with more is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi there, David.
Hey, mate.
So first of all, tell us about the questions that are being raised about the Brazilian retelling of that night.
Well, the USA Today piece is pretty extraordinary because they actually did reporting, right? So they went back. There were claims made that Lochte and perhaps his peers had destroyed this restroom at the gas station. They had broken the mirrors. They had torn down the soap dispensers. USA Today went back in the bathroom. They found the mirrors and took pictures. They were still standing. They were upright. They looked worn. Same for the soap dispensers. There was the claims that Lochte had said, a gun had been put to his head. And he says, well, that was an exaggeration. But it turns out videotape and an eyewitness who was a passing by DJ who essentially served as a translator in Portuguese to help the young athletes deal with these security officers. They said their gun was drawn and it was pointed at the athlete. And indeed, he said that he was essentially held up by cops. Well, these guys were private security guards, but they were also off-duty prison guards serving as private security. So in a sense, you have law enforcement officials pulling a gun, resolving this issue by the giving of cash to basically get these guys out of there. I think you can say that that Lochte is a pampered knucklehead Olympian. I think questions have been raised about whether or not he would have been treated the same way and believed initially had he been not white. But at the same time, a lot of the fundamentals of the story that he offers are backed up by interviews, by the videotape obtained by USA Today, and by their own on-the-scene reporting.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm seeing that Ryan Lochte's lawyer, Jeffrey Ostro, has also separately told USA Today that relying on what the Brazilians are saying as opposed to taking time to really analyze what you can see, he says is a problem, and that parts of the story that Ryan Lochte originally offered will never change. That's, again, his lawyer, Jeffrey Ostro. But I'm wondering, David, let's talk a little bit about then how the media pendulum has swung in this story. At first, of course, when Ryan Lochte made his claims, there was a great deal of support for him and lots of criticism heaped upon the Brazilians. Then it seemed to have swung completely in the opposite direction. So it sounds like really the truth is somewhere in the middle.
Well, the truth is often somewhere in the middle, but you had a series of sort of unquestioning interviews in some ways by NBC that became more pointed over time, as you say, swinging from the completely credulous Billy Bush initially to the completely incredulous or somewhat credulous Matt Lauer to then this back and forth between Al Roker and Billy Bush, where Al Roker simply said he lied and really pressed Billy Bush on his – his lack of questioning any of the fundamentals of what Lochte had offered. Roker looked like a journalistic hero, an amazing thing for a guy we best know as a weatherman on a morning show to come off as. And at the same time, NBC had an incredible flotilla of broadcasters and journalists down in Rio. They didn't do the reporting that USA Today did. And what they didn't do was ascertain what actually happened, even to take so simple a step as go initially back to the gas station and look at what happened. These guys were drunk. They urinated behind the back of the gas station. Apparently, Lochte pulled down a sign, which is, an incidental cost, a chowderhead move. You can call him what you will, and certainly a person of privilege. But, there are people in the press. Sally Jenkins in, I believe, USA Today called for him to be essentially permanently barred from competitive swimming. When you think about Michael Phelps, the nation's greatest swimmer, not only at the moment but possibly of all time, he was banned for 6 months from competition for what? For a repeated drinking under the influence offense, something which could have cost somebody his or her life. So, when you think about the offenses and the kind of rhetoric being thrown around, it is possible, I think, to be unfair even to somebody as pampered and as privileged as Ryan Lochte is these days.
Right. Well, David, in the last couple seconds that we have you, let's talk for a second about the allegations that keep coming in campaign against Roger Ailes and Fox News. A former Fox host has now filed a lawsuit yesterday claiming Fox executives punished her for complaining about sexual harassment. Tell us about that.
Well, Andrea Tantarosa was a host of The Five, one of the more popular shows on Fox. It shows up at 5 p.m. She claims that Roger Ailes sexually harassed her, that she complained about these things, and that she was essentially demoted to a less-watched show in midday called Outnumbered as a result of her complaints. But what I think is more damaging to Fox News, if it's borne out, is that she alleges not only that Ailes made sexual advances unwanted, she says Bill O'Reilly, you know, their most popular, most watched host, did so as well. He, of course, had been sued by a former producer there for just that a dozen years ago. They had to pay a lot of money to get him out from under that. And also the people who are in place now, including yeah. Bill Shine, the co-president of the network, he was labeled as an enabler and somebody who threatened her as well. So it's really labeling the culture, not simply Roger Ailes, as liable in this lawsuit.
Thanks, David.
This is Here and Now. I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting from Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming as the National Park Service celebrates its 100th birthday. And the National Park Service is part of the Interior Department. And later this week, Interior Secretary Sally Jewell will be here at Yellowstone, which is America's first national park. I spoke with her the other day and started by asking her what this anniversary means to her.
It's America's best idea. 100 years ago, in 1916, to say, let's make these iconic places that helped define the United States permanent. And as we come upon this milestone anniversary, it's a great opportunity to celebrate where we've come from, but also help prepare these parks and what they stand for the next century. So it's really exciting to be in this position at this time.
And you've said that the park system needs a course correction for conservation. What does that mean?
You know, when these parks were set aside, it was viewed as, you know, these are really special places to protect, but they were within a sea of undeveloped landscapes. You know, Yellowstone set aside in the late 1800s, and Yosemite even identified as a protected area during the Civil War by President Lincoln. I don't think people realized at that time that we would be developing so much around them. And we now know through science that parks like Yellowstone can't exist as an island unto themselves. They're part of a connected ecosystem. The animals that we think of, from the bison to the grizzly bear to the wolves, don't know boundaries. And so the future of conservation is going to be more thoughtful about how we work with public landowners and other private lands to respect the fact that our political boundaries don't necessarily align with the boundaries of the critters that rely on these places and that we want to protect for future generations. So it's going to be very different in the future than it has been in the past.
But does it mean adding more national park land to connect some of these parks so that these animals can roam from one to the other? And that obviously is not a politically popular thing to do in some circles.
No, it does not mean adding national park lands. It means recognizing that as an island, a national park cannot exist without a broader connected landscape. So it means being thoughtful about where we develop and working with private landowners to have things like wildlife-friendly fences on ranches. And we've got tremendous cooperation on the private side and with states in a number of different areas in the West so that these great iconic parks like Yellowstone can continue to have the animals and the wildlife that people come to it for many years in the future. And that just requires an area that's bigger than the national park itself. It does not mean expanding the boundaries of the park.
Which park would you say is the most threatened right now?
Oh, my goodness. You know, the biggest threat that we I'd say there's two areas of threat that we experience. One is climate change, and it is dramatically affecting many, many different parks. Jamestown, the first settlement of people of European origin in the United States, is experiencing sea level rise, and already many of the artifacts, Native American artifacts and also first settlers artifacts, are being unearthed because of sea level rise, and we're having to proactively remove them and curate them so that they don't get lost forever. So that's one of the major threats. The other threat really is people are very busy and parks aren't necessarily on their radar, and they're not They don't feel as relevant to all Americans as they could. So making parks relevant to all Americans, not just those that might have had a history growing up and going to these places, is going to be really important for the future of national parks and public lands, so that they have advocates across the country and across the political spectrum.
Yeah, last time we talked, we had talked about that issue, and you were setting up these kiosks in the parks so that people could communicate with people in other parks and trying to bring more young people, more minorities to the parks. How did that go?
Oh, it's gone very, very well. There's two key programs that we've really been emphasizing in the last year. One that you're talking about is called Find Your Park, hashtag Find Your Park, if people are on Twitter. And that has done an incredible job of putting parks and park vacations on people's radar. So 2015 was the biggest year ever with 305 million visitors to our national parks. And we are confident that 2016, this year, the year of the centennial, will be even more than that. And we are seeing increased visitation from across our wonderfully diverse spectrum of Americans and also foreign tourists, which is exactly what we'd like to see. And the other program we've launched, which is Every Kid in a Park, free pass for every fourth grader in the United States of America to take their family, their friends, a carload into the national parks for free. And those are two ways we're trying to make the parks more accessible and relevant. So they find their park, and their park may be the African burial grounds that right in New York City. It may be the Cesar Chavez National Monument down in Southern California, places that tell a broader story of America. And that is also something that we've really been highlighting in this centennial year and beyond.
But as you've tried to make the parks more relevant to certain people, there are also complaints about the parks being loved to death, that there are so many people visiting certain parks that the parks themselves may be hurt.
Well, this is always a balancing act. We've had parks like Zion, for example, that put in place a bus system to get people out of their single occupancy vehicles and take them throughout the park. That's been very successful, but the buses are pretty crowded this year. It's partly our responsibility as the National Park Service to create opportunities to explore that don't overcrowd these areas. But I will say that until parks are relevant to all Americans, we won't put the support in place needed. And we face a maintenance backlog in park infrastructure approaching $12 billion. About half of that's roads and half of that is other infrastructure. People will go out and they will see facilities that aren't up to par. But if they have a great experience, and it's hard not to have a great experience in a place like Yellowstone and Yosemite or in some of our historical parks as you learn the journey of the United States, they will be more inclined to encourage our elected officials to support them.
Well, Sally Jewell, what do you want to accomplish in the last few months of your tenure as Interior Secretary?
Well, I've got a long list in front of me that we'd like to get done. I'm very proud of the work that has been done, both through our nonprofit partners, our volunteers, philanthropists, on the National Park Centennial, and the fact that the National Park Service is America's storyteller. We don't just preserve beautiful natural places; we tell the story of America. More out there than it ever has been before. So I will be traveling all over the country telling that story. A lot of other things going on in Interior, of course, that I'll be working on between now and the end of the year, from supporting trust and treaty obligations to our first Americans and continuing a march toward a cleaner energy future. So lots to do.
And will there be any more national monument or national park designations, do you think, from President Obama before he leaves?
There are lots of places that warrant protection. President's made it clear that he's willing to use his authority under the Antiquities Act if Congress is unwilling to act. And so there are a number of areas that are under consideration. And if Congress doesn't act, there's a good chance that the president will.
I have to ask you one more thing that we didn't talk about last time we spoke, but it is something that I've become a big fan of, and a lot of other people too, more than a million people now, are following you guys on Instagram. They're following the National Park Service and the Interior Department. What is that about? Is that about just selling people on wilderness and wildlife and the national parks? And why do you think it's been so successful?
Well, Instagram is a wonderful vehicle to really leverage the fact that a picture tells a thousand words. And we have so much incredible photography that, you know, citizens out there take and send to us. And so, yes, we got a great following on Instagram. I'm the envy of some of my cabinet colleagues because their portfolios don't necessarily lend themselves to the visual imagery that we have. But it's inspirational.
The poor Department of Energy just doesn't get the same love on Instagram, probably.
Well, yeah. You know, people find inspiration in those images. And, you know, with the ability to do video and live cams on, you know, eagles and ospreys and bears, and it's pretty inspirational. And we believe that technology can be used as a tool to connect people to nature. It doesn't need to be a tool to keep us away from nature. And the more we can use imagery and fun things like the cameras that are on the wildlife to inspire people to actually get out there and see these places themselves, we think is a great thing.
So what's next for you after the Obama administration?
A long, slow road trip to really deeply enjoy our public lands in a way that this job hasn't afforded me to do. that is my plan, is to return to Seattle, but to do it with a long, slow road trip through many of our nation's public lands before I decide what's next.
That's Interior Secretary Sally Jewell. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And as we were hearing from Sally Jewell there, Old Faithful went off again, erupting right now, right in front of us. We got an eruption yesterday, live on the air, and another one today. You're listening to Here and Now, live from Old Faithful.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Blue Apron sources fresh, high-quality ingredients and sends them right to your home in pre-measured packages. You get easy-to-follow recipes so you can have a meal ready in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Own up to your mistakes. That's one of the many great lessons parents give children that also apply to corporations. Because when they don't, and the bad news first breaks through the press, well, the outcomes are oftentimes worse for companies than if they had been the first to admit to their problems. Think Theranos and Volkswagen. Well, for more, we're joined by Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Good to see you, Kurt.
Hey, Meghna.
Okay, so I mentioned Volkswagen. Remind us about the problems they had and how it caught up to them in the press.
Yeah, they're expensive problems to the tune of billions now. The company basically cheated on software in the car so that it could pass emission standards tests. And the company knew about it for a long time. Executives knew about it for a long time. But they didn't disclose the information. It came out from regulators and other people who looked into it. And so now the company is spending billions of dollars in settlements, in fines, and also faces billions of dollars in lawsuits.
Right. So the presumption there that if they had owned up to it sooner, maybe it wouldn't lead up to those billions of dollars that you were talking about.
Sure.
So let's look at the other side of the coin there. What's an example of a company that did come clean about trouble that was brewing, and how did its outcome differ?
Well, this is really kind of the point. It's hard to think of those companies because they don't stand out as much. It happens all the time, though. There are companies that disclose data breaches. There are companies that disclose when patients have died in human trials for new drugs, for instance. There are also companies that have to announce that acquisitions aren't working out well or products aren't selling. And so when they come out with bad news or crises, talk about crises in the organizations, it's information. It doesn't help them, but it also doesn't hurt them as much as when they keep it secret and it comes out another way.
Right. Some old cliches are popping into my mind about the cover-up being worse than the crime and that in this case, there is such a thing as bad publicity. So, I mean, given the fact that these companies that did admit to their errors didn't really damage their businesses as much, why is it that so many companies do just avoid talking about their troubles or their problems?
Well, it's definitely costly, right? It hurts the stock price when you come out with bad news. It hurts the brand. It hurts sales. It also reflects poorly on the people who are in charge. So the very people who are announcing the news, they're the ones who may not get as much from their stock options. Those are the same people who may lose their jobs because of this crisis or get pushed out by the board. And so bad news does have consequences. It's just that they're thinking no news is good news, so let's not talk about it. But as it turns out, there's a growing body of research that really shows that old news is better than new news. It's better if you come out with it and it seems like old news when everybody reports on it than when there's actually novel new information coming out from a new source about you.
Wow. But there's a self-preservation or self-interest issue here amongst leaders at a corporation that might stop them from making that decision.
Yeah.
Huh, interesting. So let's talk about when companies do decide to not talk about their problems and it breaks in the press. How lasting or how long can the damage be?
Oh, it can last for a long time. If you look at BP, which is a company that did not acknowledge as quickly just how bad this oil spill was in the Gulf of Mexico, how fast the oil was coming out. It just announced that its final cost for that oil spill is $61.6 billion, nearly a third of its overall value.
Wow. Kurt Nikisch with Harvard Business Review. Thanks so much, Kurt.
Sure thing.
The Minneapolis Star Tribune reported over the weekend that pills seized from Prince's home in Minnesota were falsely labeled as common generic painkillers when they actually contained fentanyl, the highly addictive synthetic opioid that killed the music star. Investigators are leaning toward the theory that Prince took the pills without knowing they contained fentanyl, and they don't yet know how he obtained the pills. He didn't have a prescription for any kind of controlled substance. But those kinds of pills are becoming increasingly available. Just last month, the Drug Enforcement Agency issued a report that said hundreds of thousands of counterfeit pills containing fentanyl have made their way onto the black market. Carol Falkowski is CEO of Drug Abuse Dialogue. She gives educational workshops about drug abuse, and she joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Yeah, thank you.
So first of all, how big of a problem do you think these counterfeit pills containing fentanyl are or are becoming?
Well, we started seeing fentanyl in this country several years ago, mostly mixed in with the street drug heroin. But in the past year or two, or year and a half even, we've increasingly seen fentanyl put into counterfeit pills that look like legitimate prescription pills. And this is a growing problem in pockets around the country and spreading.
Now, how is it that people are getting these pills? I'm going to presume they're not coming through sort of standard pharmacies that you'd go submit a prescription to, are they?
No, that's an important point. Anybody who's getting their prescriptions from a pharmacy has nothing to worry about. This does not apply to them. What we're talking about are unscrupulous people who are getting this powdered, synthetically made fentanyl, mostly from China, and then bringing it into this country, pressing it into pills themselves, and selling them on the black market. Everyone knows that this country has a large problem with heroin and opioid addiction, and people who are addicted devote their time to getting more and more of the drug, and there is a black market for prescription painkillers. So what has happened is they're now prescription painkillers that are knockoff prescription painkillers. They just look like prescription painkillers, and they have fentanyl in them. This is significant because fentanyl is 100 times stronger than morphine. It's 30 to 50 times stronger than heroin. It literally shuts down people's breathing, and we've seen a rise in overdose deaths as the result of this practice.
Right. Now, I mean, I've been seeing reports that, for example, some addiction treatment experts are even putting on gloves when they use anything related to fentanyl to treat addicts. I mean, it's a sense that it is a very dangerous substance to be around. I mean, how small, what are the trace amounts that you need to have in order for it to produce a fatal response?
A very small amount, and it literally shuts down your breathing. You know, we had the phrase, take a chill pill. Well, I think we need to do public education and somehow get the message across that if you buy a counterfeit, illegitimate, but legitimate-looking prescription pill, it should be called the kill pill.
Mm. Now, where is it that people are accessing these black market pills? Is it through the internet? I mean, I've been seeing reports that some, you know, pills are being passed around in clubs, during parties, that kind of thing. But where are they getting them?
They're, you know, all different sources. You mentioned the internet is one source, from clubs, certainly. Everybody who is involved in illegal drug abuse always knows a guy who can get them access to all sorts of illicit substances.
So in the case of what happened to Prince, investigators are saying that they were falsely labeled. The pills he took were falsely labeled as a common generic. So when people get these, is there any way to know that what the labeling says is accurate or not?
If you always get your prescription drugs from a pharmacy, none of this applies to you. Where it comes in is people buying prescription pills on the black market. So from bad guys, people who are addicted. Addiction by definition is where drug abuse is the entire focus of your life, and you develop a tolerance where you need more and more of the drug to get the same effect. So many people who become addicted to legitimate prescription painkillers may have that amount reduced by their prescribing physicians, and therefore they turn to the black market to get those same pills. Mm-hmm. What is happening now is that those same pills that look like they're legitimate prescription are in fact this deadly fentanyl.
Right.
So, and there's no way of knowing by looking at them. There's no way of knowing by crushing them. There's no way of knowing. So really, this is a game changer because we have long had an illicit underground prescription pill market. But now for the first time, these prescription knockoff pills are full of fentanyl, which is so deadly. Just the tiniest amount can shut down your breathing and kill you.
Well, we read a story about a Los Angeles County woman who bought unlicensed prescription medication for a health condition that she had. In order to save money, she bought it through these other means, and she ended up dying as a result. It feels like we're, you know, I hate to say this, but we may hear more stories like that.
Yeah, there's no reason to believe that this will not continue. The traditional means of controlling drugs by law enforcement are really challenged by this. So we need to come up with new solutions and better approaches to try to clamp down on it because it's a huge issue. We've never really had it before. In addition to the fentanyl occurring in these counterfeit prescription pills that look like legitimate pills that people get on the black market, we've also found fentanyl in mixed in with street drugs that come in powder form, like mixed in with cocaine or mixed in with heroin. And this, too, has had deadly results and dire consequences.
Well, very deadly. I mean, in many places across the country, when this happens, we hear about, you know, tens, dozens of people even overdosing in the course of, you know, a day or two because there's just this pulse of all that fentanyl-laced heroin, for example. I'm just curious. I mean, I hear the seriousness and alarm with which you're talking about how fentanyl is showing up in more and more places across the country. What do you think has to be done in order to get a handle on this problem?
Well, I've been a drug abuse epidemiologist that's looked at this issue for almost 35 years, and there has never really been something of this nature happening. It affects both the illicit prescription drug supply as well as the illicit supply of drugs that come in powder form. So it is really an issue where people do not know what they're getting, and the consequences in this case are deadly. I think we need to somehow get the prevention message out that these pills are kill pills, that you don't know what you're getting if you buy prescription pills on the black market, and if there's fentanyl in them, it can kill you. They have been labeled both as painkillers that look like painkillers, as well as benzodiazepines or Xanax, you know, tranquilizers. So it doesn't it applies to all sorts of mood-altering pills that you get illegitimately on the black market. It's not just the painkillers. We need to somehow get the message out that this is a dangerous phenomenon. Now, unfortunately, some of the past prevention messages from our government have overstated the dangers of drugs, particularly in the 1970s and 80s. There were a lot of alarming stories about how dangerous marijuana was, for example. So some credibility has been lost about what are the dangers of drugs, you know, when you put out overly alarming information and over-exaggerate it. But there is nothing that is an over-exaggeration here. There is no stretch of the truth here. This is absolutely something we have never seen before that's affecting the illicit drug abuse supply.
Well, Carol Falkowski is CEO of Drug Abuse Dialogues. Carol, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. And really, I think it's important to emphasize that if you get a prescription from your pharmacist, you have nothing to worry about. This is about people who are doing this all illegitimately, illegally on the black market.
This is Here and Now. I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting from Yellowstone National Park this week for the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. And we decided we wanted to go out and talk to some of the many people who have come here, the visitors who have come from all over the world to see this park. Where are you guys visiting from?
China.
China. Wow.
East from Texas.
Yeah.
Where are you?
Oklahoma.
Belgrade, Montana.
That's my cousin. We came up to visit him, and we got to come see Yellowstone while we're here.
And is this your first time?
No, I was here when I was a little kid.
And has
so
it,
about 30,
our first time.
30 years, and Joe's first time, yeah.
Has it changed much since you were here when you were a kid?
I don't think so. Not a lot, no. No, it's pretty neat. I mean, it's kind of what I remember, but I think I was little, like 10, so it's 40 years ago.
Still fun to see Old Faithful?
Absolutely. Can't wait. Absolutely.
Long Island, New York.
And what do you think?
It's pretty cool.
What did you think was cool?
The beehive geyser.
The beehive geyser? When did that one go off?
About like an hour ago.
It gets pretty tall, doesn't it?
Yeah. But it only goes off once a day, and we actually didn't have to wait that long, which was pretty cool.
Do you know why they erupt when they do?
There's an active volcano under it.
You got that right. Cool, well, enjoy. Where are you guys visiting from?
Italy.
Italy?
Yeah.
And how long are you here for?
Yellowstone?
Yeah.
2 days.
What do you think so far?
It's beautiful.
Is it everything you thought it would be?
Yes.
Have you seen the geyser go off?
Yeah, yeah. It's beautiful. Yes. Last year we went to Iceland, so it's the second time that we see geysers.
How does it compare to Iceland?
I think Iceland is wilder.
Wilder?
Yeah.
But there are more geysers here than in Iceland.
Yes, it's true.
Florida.
Florida?
Yeah.
What do you think so far?
Fantastic.
Have you seen this go off already?
Not yet.
Oh, so you're waiting for the first time.
Exactly.
Yeah. What else have you seen here?
Pretty much all the other ones around, some of the waterfalls and stuff. And we're making a whirlwind tour. We just got back from Alaska.
Wow.
We started in Florida and came up the southern part of it, went up Pacific Coast Highway, and now we're coming back this way, back to New York and back to Florida.
So how does this compare to all the other places you've been?
This is nice. Nice. Alaska was nice too, in Kodiak, but this is nice.
Where are you guys visiting from?
Australia.
Australia? And is this the only stop in the U.S. or are you traveling all around?
Talk to our tour guide.
Yeah, we've made a lot of stops.
And what do you think of Yellowstone?
It's good. It's good.
It sounds like it's just okay.
Yeah. A lot of people here.
Oregon.
And what brought you to Yellowstone?
Just sightseeing.
Geysers. They're the best.
Have you seen this one go off yet?
No, we haven't. We just got here.
So you will soon?
Yeah.
So what do you think so far of the park?
I think it's amazing, and it's really incredible to see all this natural life in a huge amount of area with tons of people visiting all over the year.
Have you seen any wildlife yet?
Yeah, we saw an elk earlier, and a lot of the tourists went outside to see it, even though it's pretty dangerous to go by it. But yeah, we've seen plenty of wildlife so far.
And is this your first national park, or have you been to others?
I'm pretty sure this is our first one, so it's pretty exciting.
Where are you guys visiting from?
New York.
New York City?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what do you think so far?
It's awesome.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Absolutely wonderful.
What brought you here?
Trying to show our kids that New York is a little abnormal. Trying to show them trees instead of bricks.
And geysers.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Have you guys seen this go off yet?
We caught the tail end of the last hour and a half, at last 90 minutes. So this will be a first.
This is awesome.
Fully viewing of it. So.
And how old are you guys?
I'm 9. 14.
14? And what do you think so far?
It's so cool.
What else do?
It's good.
What did you see up in the other when we went to the other place? Where did you see?
Oh, yeah, the spring thing.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
It was awesome.
It was awesome.
Do you think you'll go to more national parks?
Maybe.
What about you?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry. That's okay.
Me not. They're going to be old. They're going to leave us one day, so we'll cherish these memories, and hopefully they'll continue to do it when they have their own family. So we love this. This is what we do every year.
So some of the visitors here at Old Faithful at Yellowstone National Park, you heard a number of foreign visitors there. There are a lot of them here, but as you can hear, people from all over the world here at Old Faithful. And before we close out this hour, we want to thank the people who made this historic visit possible. The technological challenges of broadcasting from a place that is so remote are enormous. So thanks to our great technical director, Paul Vikas, with help back home from Doug Wilson, Mike Moschetto, and James Trout. At the Park Service, thanks to Morgan Worthen and Jennifer Jarrett and all the staff here at the Old Faithful Inn, including one park ranger who came up and told us that her daughter was live texting our broadcast from Yellowstone to her mom as she listened in Seattle. And thanks to Peter O'Dowd, who produced our coverage. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WVUR in association with the BBC World Service at Yellowstone National Park. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Happy birthday, America's Parks. You're looking great. It's Here and Now.